how do we use these ideas without sounding like we want to go back to the 1950s? Because that's not what we want. You know, if the 1950s were really as great as people think they were, we would not have ended up with the 1960s. So it's a matter of sort of forging a new way that feels contemporary, but at the same time is also informing who we are as women.
Hi there. Welcome to episode 2 of Girl Boss Interrupted. I'm your host, Helen Roy. In this episode, I had the immense privilege of speaking with Carrie Gress, wife, mother, author, and philosopher, about home. She co-wrote a series of work entitled The Theology of Home with Noel Mehring. And the reason why I wanted to talk about this first and foremost is because of a theme that I brought up in my introductory episode, which is transience. Transience is held up as a sort of inherent good for millennials. It's a hallmark of girl bossism. It's what enables us to endlessly pursue professional opportunities, to hop throughout the course of our lives from one cosmopolitan center to the next without any real ties to where we're living. It's a theme in many of our relationships, romantic and platonic, that we can sort of upend ourselves and the relationships without a second thought. And it's what leaves many of them feeling hollow and disposable. So for all of these reasons, I think that transience is a real cause of millennial malaise. Home is very much the opposite of transience. Home requires permanent commitments. So I think this is a good place to start because it's one of the central myths of girl bossism and the millennial female experience. Carrie writes beautifully about home and the process of homemaking and the importance of the concept of home, specifically for women, understanding that women are, practically speaking, in many cases, the anchor of homes. So I hope that you enjoy this episode. It was fascinating to speak with her. She's absolutely brilliant. And if you do, please subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. And we will talk again soon. Thanks. We're welcoming to the podcast today Dr. Carrie Gress. She's the author of several really amazing books. But the work that we're focusing on today is The Theology of Home, which she wrote with Noel Mehring. Carrie, welcome to Girl Boss Interrupted.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
I'm so excited for you to be here and to pick your brain about this topic, because as we were kind of talking about earlier, womanhood is it feels very much at a crisis point in modernity. There's so much to talk about. It's personal, it's political, it's everything. So yeah, let's just jump right in.
That sounds great.
Okay. So, to get us started, I was wondering if you could give us a little background as to what led you to start thinking about this topic, what led you to start thinking about womanhood in the way that you do, and how that sort of unfolded into your work journey.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, there's a very long story and there's a very short story, so I'll probably just give you the short story. But I came back to the Catholic Church. I never really left it, but I never really believed much about it when I was a young woman, probably when I was in college. And, you know, when I was in college, I can see very clearly there was, you know, the hookup culture on one hand, and then I had a grandmother who was very involved in the New Age, and I was just navigating all of this and trying to figure out, like, what was truth. And my father had passed away as well. So, you know, at that point, I'm asking really big questions in my life. I'm not just happy to kind of go along with the culture at that point. So anyway, I had this conversion, and I really wanted to be able to speak to other women about our faith, and I just, you know, about the Catholic faith. And I didn't know how to give it to them. I didn't know how to explain it. And I thought, okay, I'm going to do this doctorate in philosophy, and then I'll really be able to explain it. And, you know, we live in a very post-logical, post-rational age. And I, of course, I didn't realize that either until I got to the other side of it and was like, wow, this isn't going to work either. But even when I was doing philosophy, when I was studying it, you know, came to a certain point where I think I probably said out loud, you know, God, I am never going to work on women's issues. And part of that was because everything that I was encountering was so esoteric. It was so full of jargon. You know, you really needed almost a PhD in philosophy to understand what was being said, to the nuances of the language. And, you know, I just thought this is not the kind of thing I can give to anybody, any woman that I know. Like, there's just no way they're going to read it or be able to understand it. So I really gave up on it at that point. And then I finally finished my doctorate after I had had three children and, you know, was a stay-at-home mom. And at that point, you know, when you finish a PhD, I think mine was 300,000 words and five different languages, six different languages. And so I thought, I can write books. And wow. Yeah, so suddenly I, you know, writing a shorter book of somewhere between 30 and 60,000 words didn't sound so intimidating. So, but the one thing that I wrote, the first thing I wrote about in women's issues was motherhood, because, you know, as a new mom, I kept expecting motherhood to get easier. I kept waiting, you know, next week's going to be easier. She won't be sick or she won't be teething or, you know, something will break. And, it never got easier. You know, I ended up getting, I had four children. They're all about 22 months apart. And it just never got easier. So the insight that I got was like, wow, it's not supposed to get easier. You're actually, you know, you're supposed to be able to weather these things and grow in virtue, that there's something to this idea of motherhood. It really teaches us something. It, you know, gets us out of ourselves and it gets us focused on someone else and their needs and, you know, kind of like demolishes that narcissism that I think is so prevalent in the culture. So the first book I wrote was called Ultimate Makeover, The Transforming Power of Motherhood. And that was just, a real watershed for me, because I realized that there was a way to write a book without it being full of jargon and a way to reach women and, you know, with something that was compelling. But the real kind of aha moment that I had about all of this was when I wrote the book called Anti-Mary Exposed, Rescuing the Culture from Toxic Femininity. And in that book, you know, I spent 2 years really researching what had destroyed the culture, why it is that we're in the situation that we are in with women right now. And, you know, I went back to the 60s and the 70s. And one of the things that became resoundingly clear to me was just to see that the reason why these women in the 60s and 70s, these radical feminists, you know, have been able to put forward this mission, and it really was a mission. They haven't had to change their sound bites really in 50 years. It's still playing itself out. The way they were so successful was because they used the media so well. They used magazines so well. They, you know, they had Oprah. They just had these incredible women who were very charismatic and really articulate, and they used all these amazing visuals, and they just got all of us thinking that this is really what we were supposed to do to make ourselves happy. This is how women are supposed to be. And, you know, all of those things I started questioning at different stages in my journey, but it really became so clear to me, like, this was the fulcrum. This was really how they were so successful. And so that's where the idea for Theology of Home came about, and doing this book. That Theology of Home is, it looks like a coffee table book, but it's actually got really rich content in it. It's got beautiful visuals. We have an amazing photographer. But we have pictures in it, and we have, you know, this coffee table-esque book, because we thought, why don't we put something forward that uses what the left uses, like a magazine, but with our values and ideas in it, instead of always just giving more and more way to the culture. Why don't we do this? And so that's really where the idea came from, was that they've been using these tactics for so long. And, you know, here we are on our side constantly trying to, you know, use, whether it's more apologetics or it's more logic and argumentation, but we're always missing what we think of as fluff, the magazine's aspect. And so I've been just, I've become really convicted that this is a really important piece for us to start plugging ourselves into. And, you know, Noelle and I joke about the pictures in this book being kind of forbidden pictures because they show men that look really competent and they're good dads and, you know, they love their children and they know how to engage with them. And, you know, there's not just 1.2, but there's many children and larger families and, you know, pregnant women, you know, all those things that you're not going to see in a women's magazine, but I think are so compelling to women when they see them. And, you know, that's the, I think sort of the point is that when women actually see what it is that they're supposed to do, it's very intuitive. Unless you have a woman who's incredibly broken and deeply, deeply broken. And I know they're out there. Most of us gravitate towards this. Most of us find it really compelling and beautiful and interesting and very foreign, but familiar somehow. So that's really kind of the short version of, you know, 30 years of this journey.
Yeah. I so agree with you about aesthetics and, just that being the reason that, these ideological forces that atomize and hurt people and demoralize them have been so successful because they're masters of branding, really. And it is important. It is, it's so important. I think aesthetics also speak specifically to like the female soul.
Absolutely.
Because I'm not exactly sure what it is, but in the same way that just beauty makes sense to women or beauty is not that it doesn't make sense to men, but like a certain sort of daily, I'll use the word mundane, but I don't mean it in any sort of negative sense, but you know, that sort of like seeing mundane, seeing the beauty in the mundane, maybe that's something that I think women have like a special talent for. And it feels like we've been, you know, psyoped into thinking that nothing mundane can be beautiful and that, you know, the good life is to be sought and achieved far away from wherever you are.
I think you're right. I think there's something about getting ideas from the visual that we somehow can take into ourselves, whether it's just into our minds and sort of relish in it, or if it's like an idea that we can then integrate into our home. I think the visuals is really important, that it's just somehow what that beauty is absorbed and we find it compelling and inspiring. And I know when I was really in knee deep with my small children, my mother-in-law had gotten me a subscription to Real Simple. And that was like my break. You know, I would have 10 minutes and I would just sit there by myself, like the baby's napping and the other three are quiet. And I would just flip through a magazine and just, it felt like I went somewhere else. You know, there's something about it that is just really compelling to women. And I think that that's what men just, they don't get it. And it's not a fault of their own, but there's just something very, you know, beautiful and magical and that grips us about magazines. And especially when they go through different topics and the tips, you know, all of those things I think are just kind of part of the feminine soul. Yeah. They're not new. They've just been usurped by someone, about people that have been abusing it, really.
Not new and not shallow.
Yeah.
So that's a great launching point to get into some questions I have about your work. Some that you've kind of already answered, but I'll just start with, you know, what is the purpose? Well, actually, I'll start with, what is a theology of home? What does that mean?
What does that mean? I think that's a great question. The theology of home really is this idea of God in our homes. And, you know, our homes are really meant to be a foretaste of heaven. We have this capacity to feel and see and get a tiny window into what heaven will be like when our homes are, when they're ordered, when they're ruled by love, when people put other people before themselves, when they're, you know, that great gift of self. All of those things are happening. It could also include very tangible things. Order is certainly one of them. When you're not in a home of complete chaos, which of course, when you have small children, there's going to be chaos. I'm not trying to say that shouldn't exist. But it's these kinds of things that really lend itself to where you can actually say, I can imagine what heaven is like because of this inner communion that I have with these people in my home. And this inner communion really reflects, of course, the Trinity as well, that abiding that they do with one another. And we hope when, you know, we grow in grace and holiness, we have that in our own souls. And then that's shared with our children. And it just grows in its own organic way. We also know that home can be a foretaste of hell. I mean, you can imagine very, very easily what that looks like. And you could probably imagine homes that you've been in or experienced that have that kind of foretaste of the awful. But home is also something that, and we chose it because it's something that everybody can relate to. You know, even if you're homeless, you feel it keenly. There's something wrong. So all of these kinds of things were really went into this thinking about theology of home. And I was really shocked that, you know, when I started thinking about it more deeply, like, why hasn't anybody done this before? You know, how did I think of this? And obviously, you know, I'm sure it wasn't my original idea. But the whole goal of our lives really is to get to the eternal home, to get to heaven. I mean, this is what we're doing with our children. We're trying to bring them there along with us. So, yeah, I think that all of those things are sort of rolled into it on a very theoretical level. And so what we're trying to do is sort of that balance of what does it this mean theoretically and theologically, you know, in this abstract way. But then how do you take those abstractions and put them into very tangible ways into your home? And so that's how why we even in the first book, we look very closely at these elements that, you know, you find in the home, but you also find them in a church. And then we also know that they're found in heaven. Things like light and comfort and safety, you know, those are elements that are, you know, are, even though they're expressed in different ways in those different places, they can certainly be found in the home. So that was really it was, and I think too, just even the question of why it is that we want to decorate our homes and why it is we have this desire to make our homes like a sanctuary. You know, what's behind that? It's not just vanity. There's a lot more at play going on, you know, with that desire than I think most of us even realize.
I'm waiting on somebody to do some sort of offer some sort of philosophical explanation for the nesting instinct, which for me right now is like full blast, you know, but it's so real. And it doesn't feel superficial. Yeah. It really doesn't. It feels like, it's just, it feels deeply feminine.
Well, you can see how it plays itself out on a practical level though, that all this nesting isn't wasted, because these are things you can't do after you have the baby. You know, that these are things that are in anticipation of it and preparation in a really beautiful way. Yeah. So yeah, I think there's that maybe we'll tackle that in the future. But I think that's a great question, because having been someone that felt it keenly, it feels really authentic. You know, it's very real.
There are these periods of women's lives, it seems, that that go sort of unexplored. Generally speaking, I think theology of home really addresses that aspect, which I think for most of human history has been more implicit or maybe, you know, a matter of oral tradition or just practical tradition. But like with as so many aspects of familial life have crumbled, this deeply feminine practice of homemaking seems like what's necessary now for so many young women who are having children and who know in their hearts that they want that, but there isn't the tradition anymore that they can draw on. It feels like for so many, you know, for people my age and these moms groups that I'm a part of, like, we're looking for somebody to explain to us what these seasons of life are for and what they mean, because, you know, when it's devalued in the broader society and you feel, incompetent at the same time, I think that this genuinely leads to, you know, frankly, depression for a lot of women. And it's a mm-hmm. problem. So I think that mm-hmm. like, I think that your book, I mean, I just would recommend it to anyone listening, all of them. It's Theology of Home 1 and 2, but have you published a third one?
It's coming out in May.
Okay. Yeah, okay.
It'll be out soon. It's At the Sea. So it's a little bit different take on it, but yeah.
Oh, okay. That's cool. We're focusing on. Very cool. But anyway, I recommend that all listeners buy it because it's one of the few works of mm-hmm. you know, just works of literature. Of it's such a combination of different things. It's, you know, philosophy and practicality and everything. But it really, it uniquely, and I this probably explains, in my opinion, some of the your success, is that it uniquely mm-hmm. describes one of these, or these aspects of women's lives that just feel so invisible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think, you know, that's obviously been very intentional because Noelle and I recognize we see these blind spots and we see, you know, even talking about homemaking is so taboo. But all the things that go into homemaking are very popular right now. So, you know, the culture just hasn't connected those dots yet. Like, okay, maybe knitting and cooking and all of these DIY shows are sort of pointing to something, a certain hunger that people have. Because they know their audience too. I mean, it's a significantly women. They've changed, you know, a lot of the, like the food competition shows are really to try and get men more engaged in watching these channels. But by and large, you know, knitting and sewing, you know, all of these things that certainly even took off, you know, the bread baking that took off certainly during the lockdowns. You know, we love the idea of home and embellishing the home, but we haven't gotten back to that idea of like, okay, homemaking is actually a good thing. You need a homemaker to make the home.
Right.
So I think it was, you know, one of the things that we've tried to do too is how do we use these ideas without sounding like we want to go back to the 1950s? Because mm-hmm. that's not what we want. You know, if the 1950s were really as great as people think they were, we would not have ended up with the 1960s. So it's a matter of sort of forging a new way that feels contemporary, but at the same time is also informing who we are as women. And, you know, in a certain respect, it's sort of like, for us, it's like shooting a fish in a barrel because nobody's doing this. Everybody's really afraid to speak about what womanhood is. And, you know, for good reason, because it's hard and challenging and you're worried you're going to get canceled and people are going to, you know, misconstrue what you're saying, or, you know, there's so many reasons not to. And yet, gratefully, you know, I think we've come up with a kind of a recipe, if you will, that kind of skirts a lot of those issues because we're trying to use different language and put them in a context that helps them feel fresh and not like we're trying to go back to something. So, yeah, I think it's a real challenge to find even resources that that deal with any of this. You almost have to sort of cobble things together from the past and then feel like read them through a newer lens too.
Yeah, absolutely. That kind of dovetails with my next question, which was that, you know, the connection between home and like the practical act of keeping a home and one's spiritual life is not maybe not intuitive to people in the secular environment. Mm-hmm. And so how do you draw mm-hmm. that? How do you connect those dots for people?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess that's a nice thing is that it's not even just, you don't even have to be a Christian or a Jew. You know, you can go back to the ancient Greeks mm-hmm. and the ancient Greeks really understood. I mean, this is the definition of happiness for them was living a virtuous life. And this is really what motherhood does is it pulls virtues out of you. You know, I joke, like, think about how nice I'm going to be when I finally am sleeping again. I'm not nursing it. I'm not nursing this baby.
Oh my
God. You know, I'm going to be a really nice mom. because I've had all these years of practice of not getting enough sleep at night and still trying to get through the day mm-hmm. functioning. But that virtue has been built up of, you know, trying to be patient and kind, you know, in the midst of all of that, because nobody wants to be around a cranky mom. And, you know, I realized that very, very quickly. And I don't even want to be around a cranky mom. So, I think that that's kind of the certainly an exciting element of it is that this is just, you know, it started in paganism. And then, of course, Christianity with someone like Thomas Aquinas took this on and sort of baptized these ideas and brought the spiritual life into it, you know, brought God into it in a way that the pagans hadn't. So absolutely. I think that this is kind of the exciting thing, is to sort of see, what is God doing with this? What is he tearing out? What is he rewiring? And, I went through a stage where, I mean, it was the weirdest stage of my life. I had friends all over the world, and I didn't have a single friend here in where I lived. I would meet people and they would move away. It's a very transient area. It was just a really strange period of my life, but I look back at that and I can see, God, what was God teaching me in that? He was teaching me to rely on him. He was teaching me how to pray in a different way. But he was also teaching me just how to live as a mom and not be so reliant on kind of the outside world that I had been. I traveled a lot. I lived all over the place. I lived in Rome. I lived in Poland. I lived in France. I grew up on the West Coast, so I was used to traveling back to see my family a lot. And, all of those things that I had gotten so used to really were stripped from me. And so I had to learn how to just be this mom and focus on these children and their needs and the virtues that were, attendant to that. And of course the needs of my husband as well. So, I really see it, my spiritual director and I talk about this a lot. There was just this stripping of, a lot of these vices that I had. And obviously, I can see significant amount of progress, but plenty more, of course, as well. But yeah, it's just an amazing thing when you kind of look back, when you're in the weeds of it, it's very hard to see, what the Holy Spirit's doing. But then when you kind of can step away from it a little bit and get a breather, I think then it kind of becomes clear that something else is going on and I'm not the same person in any respect, that I was when, this whole process started.
Oh, I really appreciate that. The words you used, the sort of stripping down, that feels very real. It feels like, that a motherhood journey is as much an exercise in humility as any other virtue, because, and I think especially now for women who have been in a lot of good ways empowered, and in a lot of really, really toxic ways empowered. And, but it's this, immediately from the very beginning, it's like it's a confrontation with life and death. Like your mortality sort of hits you in the face first. Then, I don't know. It's just like it's a constant reminder that your choices matter, I think, and that nothing is consequence free. And that is what it feels like. I mean, I'm certainly not as far down this road as you are, but like what you're saying really makes sense. And it actually, it kind of gets to the question that I want to ask all of my guests on this podcast and the real purpose of this podcast, which is to envision and explicate a better way of living and to answer the question, what does it mean to live virtuously as a woman in the 21st century? I'll leave that open to you.
Leave it at that. Okay. Well, I think, we've spent so much time thinking about power, and that's really been the goal of the feminist movement, is power. But I think what it's done is it's torn our hearts out. We're not heartened. We don't know what it means to love people. And this is the biggest tragedy, because women are made for very thick, long-term relationships. This still perdures. I mean, you can still see this in women today. We want, we're dialed into faces and their expressions and the emotions and all of those things. They haven't been able to tear that out of us yet. And for good reason. We're incredibly hardwired into that. That's kind of our job. So I would love to see, getting back to this idea of what does it mean to be a woman? And that's the question that the culture can't answer anymore. But it really comes back to this idea of, Edith Stein has this great line about women's souls are made to shelter other souls. I think you could go beyond that. I think it also helps. We're called to generate, but we're also called to cultivate other souls. When you watch a gifted teacher, and obviously men can do this as well, but women are really good at this, just intuitively, of pulling the goodness out of another soul when they're teaching them. You know, these are things that we've really forgotten that we have the capacity to do. And we've also forgotten that they're incredibly important to do, because we've made everything that we're doing, you know, that you're important if you're mimicking what men are doing. And this is, we've completely forgotten what it means, what womanhood means. And that's why we can't define it. So I would love to go back to this idea of, like, what does it mean to be, have the heart of a woman, and really follow that out and really, see the capacity that women have to care for others. And that's where the real beauty is when we can get beyond ourselves and our own, you know, vices, and move into this place where, you know, we're really caring for other people and helping them become the people that God created them to be, and focused on that, whether it's on the spiritual level or the material level, whether we have biological children or spiritual children. And I answer this question a lot too, especially for women that haven't had children. You know, what are they supposed to do? And you know, there's all these layers of people that God is going to put into our lives when we're open to it, and these different ways in which He wants us to help them, but we're also helped through it because we learn how, you know, how to live that virtuous life of helping them in a way that helps them, that isn't self-serving. I mean, it's certainly it pulls us out of ourselves when we're helping them. And that's what we have to get out of, is we have to get deeper into how it is that we can help others, instead of just focusing on ourselves. I think that's probably the quickest way to sum it up.
No, I think that's right. I've written this before, and it feels true that, like, the really deep core issue with feminism, or, you know, there are several, let's be real. But
yeah, there are many.
It does not account for the world beyond the self. And and in that, it does not account for love.
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely.
So, you know, what do you have if you have this, you have this image of feminist perfection, but you have no love? And that really, that I think is what is driving the awakening that I'm attempting to document through this podcast, which is that that was sort of a long time coming, I think, but tipped off by coronavirus, which is that, you know, women have begun to feel, especially millennial women, have begun to feel the effects of this lovelessness in their lives. And it's scary. Mm-hmm. It's not a good thing.
And it's great that it's happening at that stage, because I deal with women, you know, every week that are at much later stage in their life, and they finally are realizing, like, wait a minute, I did everything the culture told me to do, and I'm miserable. You know, what do I have in my life? My parents have died. I didn't have any siblings. I'm not married. I don't have children. You know, I mean, that's an incredibly difficult place to be that isolated. And, you know, we know that that's what Satan wants to do to us too, is just make us so we feel alone, and then make us live with regret, especially if we've had abortions or things like that. Right. He's going to really turn that knife, you know, becomes the accuser in that situation. And then that's when real havoc can happen. So that's the real, I think, the real tragedy. So it's an amazing, it's a beautiful, and I love hearing that, you know, millennial women are starting to question this, because you still have time to have children and, you know, make a different life than you would if you discovered this at 50 or 60.
Right. So, final question here. Actually, there's two. Let me ask this one, because this is sort of particular too. What particular virtues do you think that these times specifically require in women? Aside from the sort of, you know, general virtue of being a woman, and what Edith Stein said about caring for other souls, what particular, in a very timely sense, do you think would be good for women to cultivate?
You know, this is not one of the Greek virtues, but I think just even the virtue of being gracious. I think that this is the one thing that is completely missed. You know, and I hear from a lot of men that are complain about women, and it's usually, you know, that they're body and loud and, you know, just so self-absorbed and all of that. And this is what I think graciousness is. It's very uniquely female. It's really being dialed into another person. And looking at their needs through the question of, you know, what can I do for you? But it's also kind and it's also gentle. And those are, you know, none of those things do we see really in the culture in a very healthy way. They're very, you know, there's the sort of mischaracterization of women that don't espouse feminism, which, you know, they make us out to be doormats. But there's nothing doormatty about a woman who is gracious, because she's using her intelligence and her heart together to say, how do I help this person? Or how do I love this person the way that they need to be loved? You know, what can I do, because God's put this person into my life? Mm-hmm. Even if it's, you know, something as simple as dealing with waiters and waitresses, or, you know, at the airport or whatnot. I mean, those, it's just so unexpected. I think that people are really shocked by it too. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I would say, defining it very explicitly, I think graciousness is really an important element, where you're not, you know, it's not about you. It's about being present to others.
I love that. And my final question here is, what's a real choice that, let's say, a young woman who finds herself disenchanted with the culture,
right?
What's a real practical choice that she can make today to improve her life?
Something she can do. Yeah, well, this is a very personal answer, because I had this very explicit moment in my life where I kept having boyfriends break up with me, and they would marry kindergarten teachers. Like, immediately after me, they would meet this kindergarten teacher right here. And I was like, what is going on? What's with the kindergarten teacher? And, you know, I'm doing a PhD in philosophy. I'm working on K Street in Washington. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm wearing the right clothes. I'm wearing the right make. Like, what am I doing wrong? And I overheard my boss one day say something about a woman. And he said, oh, she's so sweet. And I probably, like, could have hit my head on the desk or something. Like, I was probably on the floor picking something up and probably, you know, could have fallen over, because I was like, what? I don't even know what that means. You know, what is that word? And so I started really thinking about it. Like, what does it mean to be sweet? And, you know, the funny thing is if you look at music and poetry, I mean, there's a very specific way and very specific things that men love about women, and sweetness is among them. And this is one of those things that, again, has become so saccharine, and it's become so mischaracterized that we don't really even know what it means. So I thought, okay, I'm going to start, I'm going to pay attention to this. What does this mean? So, you know, of course I'm looking at the kindergarten teacher, and, you know, she's kind and she's sweet and she's, you know, she's present. And anyway, so I changed a little bit the way that I wore my clothes. I changed kind of the way that I responded to people. And like a year later, I was in the metro. It was an August day. And I remember this young man walking up to me and saying, are you a school teacher? And I said, no. And, you know, I just smiled and walked off. And that was like the moment of triumph for me. Like, I realized that I was transformed. You know, I must have smiled at him. You know, I don't even know what precipitated it. I was dressed differently. I don't know. But that was a real turning point for me. You know, I was still doing all the things I had done before. I didn't have to change my life very much, but I just had to smile and look people in the eye and you know, be gracious. And that was really, so I would say, and even if it sounds repulsive to you on the outset, think about it. Look at poetry, look at music, listen to song lyrics you like, and listen to what it is that men say about women when they don't think we're listening. And that's when you know, I think that's the easiest thing to change about ourselves. That's not taught. It's something that you just kind of have to absorb and figure out, I think. I think that that's the one thing that women can do to just really on a dime change their life and the trajectory that their lives are on. I know it changed mine.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think it changed mine too. I actually, I think the way that I grew up and just the messaging that you get.
Yeah, you didn't hear anything about it. Yeah.
No, the girl bossism is insidious precisely because it roots out sweetness. Mm-hmm. But you know, to coming back to that, it isn't even just simply a matter of, you know, gaining more positive male attention. It's for yourself. No. It's for your own sake, like to soften your own heart, I think is.
And that's a great and important distinction. I'm glad you brought that up because you're right. It wasn't about attention. It was about, again, back to that idea of relationships that felt authentic and healthy instead of toxic and like a competition.
It's a war of all against all. And that's the best way to remove yourself, probably.
Yeah, exactly.
Carrie, I am so honored that I was able to speak to you today. I thank you for everything that you've shared. Do you have any parting thoughts or anything that you'd like to share before we go?
You know, I think I've covered a lot of ground, but you had great questions. But, you know, I think that your articulation of the girl boss is really fantastic and just such a great, you know, even one word way of helping us like encapsulate what it is that we've been really brainwashed into. So I just want to thank you for that, because I think that that's an important thing, just that soundbite. And that's what we aren't really good at doing on the right and in conservative circles, is coming up with a soundbite that really unmasks something. So I would just, you know, congratulate you on coming up with that idea that I think so many of us can relate to, and helping us to get out of that, you know, cycle that we've been stuck in. So well done.
Thank you, Carrie. I really appreciate that. I'm going to take that to the grave. All right. Well, we will let you go. Both busy moms have to get back to our lives here. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in today. As just a reminder, you can find us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. And Dr. Carrie Gress, I look forward to speaking to you again someday, hopefully.
That sounds great. I have another book coming out eventually on women. So hopefully once I finally get that written, I'd love to chat with you about it. So thanks so much for having me.
All right. Thank you.